Support comes from Kenai Feed, mile 14.5 K Beach Road, with high tunnels, gardening supplies, and animal feed, open 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. KenaiFeed.com.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain come tumbling down. Pulling weeds, picking stones, we are made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, for the time is close.
Feeling the need to grow my own, that's exactly right, and that's what we're doing, folks. We are gardening. And, you know, before I get started with a couple of items, I want to first off welcome you to Growing a Greener Kenai with me, Larry Opperman. And I have a special guest today. You folks have heard him before, but it's been a while. My friend David Regal, who is a retired landscape architect. And we're pleased to have him with me today. David, welcome back to Growing a Greener Kenai.
Thank you, Larry. I'll do the best I can to do that special part.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know... David and I, we're both getting a little bit older, and we, you know, but it's like my wife and I say, you know, we're getting older. We like two half brains make a whole brain, so we'll be okay there.
We'll do the best we can.
We'll do the best we can. That's exactly right. Well, folks, before we get going to too much more, I want to give you a quick weather report, and if you noticed, it's raining, and it's 53 right now. It's raining. Chance of rain today. Supposed to maybe clear up a little bit. Chance of rain cloudy with a high near 59. South winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Chance of precip is 50%. And then as we get through the weekend, a little bit of showers through Sunday. And then next week we get mostly sunny, clear, sunny, cloudy, sunny. And, you know, David, that's actually been absolutely great for our gardens. I mean, we get a little bit of rain, and when we're getting 4 and 5 days of nice sunshine and a little bit of rain, and it's... Boy, it's working great.
Yeah, right when we are finishing up our garden.
Yeah, no kidding. So the weather's not bad at all, and then we don't get back to a chance of rain until Thursday, which would be about right to water the outside garden again. And then for you folks that like to fish, I always like to give also a quick marine forecast. We're sitting there, Catchmack Bay is about two feet swells, and even out at the Barren Islands, if you're going out of Homer, those seas aren't too bad. They're up 2 to 4 feet, which you folks that have listened to me before know I always put a pukeability index on those for me. And that's kind of a mid-range pukeability index.
It's just beyond four
yeah.
foot.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for you folks there, again, one of the things we're Dave and I are going to talk about in a little bit is we're preserving food. It's time to start thinking about that. But, you know, the Kenai River is setting records for the run. After today's run, they will hit 3 million fish counted. It's just incredible. It's just incredible. And for you folks that are out there listening, too, you happen to know that the traffic is incredible in the area, isn't it? But we're not here to talk about fish. We're here to talk
our traffic.
Or traffic, that's right. And... one of the things I want to remind everyone, too, and even though we've got this rain, you know, the don't forget you need a burn permit to get out there, and we're safe right now. But if it makes you uncomfortable to burn, don't forget about, I always mention this to you folks, don't forget about just north of the soccer fields going out of Kenai is the free dump for brush. Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 6. No questions asked. That's a free service put on by the – I thought it was put on by the borough, but it's apparently put on by the city.
Oh, good.
By Kenai. Yep. Right, right. And, you know, one of the other things that I wanted to bring up, if you guys were at the Progress Days Parade, the Central Peninsula Garden Club had a wonderful, wonderful float in there. And in fact, Mr. David here with me,
oh,
he
boy.
Was a walking carrot.
He was a walking carrot in the parade. You had to bring that up.
He was a walking carrot. And I'll tell you what, it was really a nice float. And one of our other friends, Michael Hasmeyer, on the mm-hmm. board, he was, let's see, was he a cabbage leaf or was he?
He was kale.
He was kale, that's right.
The least likely or yeah. likable.
Yeah.
Depending on how you no want to look kidding. At it.
And the Garden Club treasurer, she was so disgusted she didn't win a the float didn't win a single thing in the parade. And who won the parade for the best float, which wasn't a float, was the Weenie Dogs, which Taro Bell had a cow.
Well,
which you heard the Weenie
I'm
Dogs
about
won.
To put a protest into the management of that.
But
if,
it was
if
a,
that's all it took, we should have had a whole bunch of other dog breeds in there. Right?
Yeah, but it was absolutely a great parade, and it was a nice day. And
beautiful.
David was a good sport walking beautiful. That way dressed as a giant carrot.
It's all right.
Yeah, it was.
Nobody knows who's in the carrot.
Yeah, that was really a cool
yeah.
parade.
Yeah.
And then one other thing I want to let folks know: it's time to start thinking about if you want to go. But coming up in February is the Northwest Flower and Garden Show in Seattle. It is the second largest garden show in the country behind the show in Philadelphia. And the thing that makes it tough, I'd love to go to the Philadelphia show one of these days. But they usually have this, and it's tough for the vendors that want to go to both of them
yeah.
because the Northwest Flower and Garden Show is 1 week, and then literally the next week is the Philadelphia show. So you got these folks that the show ends on a Sunday. It goes a Wednesday through Sunday, and you got these folks in Seattle. Now to get to the Philadelphia, they got to book it.
It's a cannonball run.
Yeah, they have got to get it
yeah.
to Philadelphia for that show. You know, but I'll tell you what, if you've never been, it is literally... It is worth going to, folks, if you've never been to that.
You get pulled over and you can explain to the policeman that you're hurrying to Philadelphia.
That's
you
right.
Were,
I'm
you
ready.
Were late.
I've got
you
some
were
broccoli.
Late already.
I've got broccoli that's getting ready to go bad.
That's right.
And speaking of broccoli, you know, gardeners, our gardening friends, it is time. We are harvesting. We are harvesting right now, and this last week, my wife Marty and I, we picked and we preserved over 20 nice heads of broccoli. And, you know, Marty and I figure we've got broccoli for the winter.
For the winter. You're done.
For the winter. And,
yeah.
and I, and you know, and I'm, and this is one of those things, David, that I've mentioned to folks. My vacuum sealer
mm-hmm.
finally crapped out after owning it for 30 years. It crapped out. So what Marty does is she takes the broccoli.
Now listen closely.
That's right.
Anybody can do this.
That's right. She takes the broccoli and she cuts it into the size she wants, and then she parboils it mm-hmm. for literally a minute, or you don't need much, and then she puts it in the cold water to stop mm-hmm. the cooking process, and then she lays them out on cookie sheets,
mm-hmm.
and she sets them down in the freezer just like that.
Okay.
And they freeze. And then, since I don't have a vacuum packer anymore, she fills up 1 gallon zipper bags, like a Ziploc bag or whatever
right.
brand you like
right.
to use. She puts them in there, and then I hit the zipper all the way over till one corner until a straw fits in there. And then I exhale real hard, and then I suck on that straw, and it sucks that plastic down just like a vacuum sealer. And right at the right point, I pull straw out and seal it. And I'll tell you what, folks, it is as good as a vacuum packer.
Uh-oh.
Now, I'm going to get another vacuum packer.
I was going to say, so much for that free, you know, vacuum packer that you were hoping for.
Yeah, I think I'll get another vacuum sealer, but I haven't found the one I want to get yet.
Right.
But the thing that's cool about it is it works. That works. And another way you can do this, but I don't think it's as much fun, if you take that bag of whatever you're preserving and you set it down in water
mm-hmm.
and you make sure water doesn't get in, that water will press in on the plastic and expel all the air.
Because
that's the, I think you folks know, that's the secret of properly freezing something is getting as much air out as you want, because you don't want your stuff you've worked so hard for to get freezer burned.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, and I did that with the fish I caught this year. I put them in the bag and I suck the air out.
What you're talking about is methods that you can use in a dry cabin and an off-grid cabin.
Absolutely.
Just because you can't plug it in doesn't mean you can't, you know, get the job done.
That is exactly right. Yeah. You know, and but yeah, the gardens are doing great, and you folks, I know you know now too, that what's happening in the garden too is there's now we're starting to get garden waste, picking things, having leaves that are pruned off, and those are the prime items that can go in your compost pile. Now, I used to have a shredder, and I don't have the shredder anymore. And I don't know why I got rid of it. I bought one that would do limbs, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I realized I didn't have that many limbs to do, right. so I sold it. But what I do, folks, is I put like leaves from whatever plant, broccoli leaves, everything that you put in a kind of laid out in the yard, and then I go over it with a lawnmower,
right,
and it throws it in the bag,
right,
and it'll compost in a compost pile a full leaf. But it goes so much faster if you can decrease the size of that and get it in your pile.
Increase the surface area.
Yeah. And it will it'll go in the bag in your mower. And even if you don't have a bagging mower, if you do something like, even if you've got a scrap piece of plywood or something, if you can kind of stand it up and prop it with a couple 2x4s or something, and you blow that waste into that board, it'll collect it all in one location.
Another way of avoiding plugging something in.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it works. Now, that's the only thing I use my push. I've got a ride mower, but mm-hmm. the only thing I pretty much use my push mower for mm-hmm. anymore is
preparing compost.
Preparing compost, that's right. And I just cut the grass the other day, and I used my tractor and I layered my grass and stuff again, and it's back up to, I got it up to like 145, 150 degrees, and that's what you need to do to kill those weed seeds that are in that compost pile. And it's amazing. You know, what's amazing to me, David, is as I work on them, the compost pile is a certain size, and I add all this stuff to it, and it builds the pile up, and then all of a sudden, it's like the pile's the same size.
Well, that's the whole point.
That's right.
Isn't it? I like the idea of the things that we need that are essential. One is a pruner, right? A hand pruner.
Yeah.
The other is a thermometer. And I don't know if anybody would have put the two in the same category, but you can't do, you know, it's like these are, why should you give your gardener a really nice probing thermometer? It's part of the deal. It's part of the equipment that you need to do it properly.
And my probe that I, and you can use some of these probes, temperature probes for different, you can stick it in your garden soil. Yeah. In the spring, see what your soil temps are.
Oh, you need
are.
It. That's what I'm saying. You don't need it just for compost.
Right.
You need it as bad as you do your hand pruning.
You're not kidding. And so I always get my pile ready after I'm done cutting the grass and building the pile back, and then I stick that thermometer mm-hmm. down there in the heart of the pile.
Yeah.
And you know, David, that obviously when you're getting up to 140 plus degrees, I go, you can't put your hand in there. It burns you. I've tried it.
Does it give you an accurate, you know, understanding of what's going
right.
on.
Right. And whenever I flip the pile over something, it just smokes.
Sure.
It's steaming and smoking. But that's what you need to, and you can cold compost. That works too. It just takes longer. But that's what it takes to kill the weed seeds. Mm-hmm. You know, because when I cut, I don't worry about dandelion seed heads. I don't worry about any of that. And it works. It mm-hmm. kills those seeds. And it does a number on them, but Marty harvested a bunch of her herbs.
Yeah,
that's
a labor of love.
She harvested a bunch of basil.
Yeah,
and what she does is she blanches it again mm-hmm. in some hot water, and then she puts it in. Put it in a little food processor and mm-hmm. kind of break it up a little mm-hmm. bit. Mm-hmm. And then she puts it in ice cube trays
right.
with olive oil.
Okay.
And that olive oil will freeze.
Oh.
believe it or not, yeah. olive oil will freeze. Yeah. And then you get these cubes of olive oil with basil in them. She puts it in a big Ziploc bag in the freezer, and she's got little...
little doses.
Little seasonings of, yeah. And it works great.
You can throw that into anything.
Throw that in the spaghetti yeah. sauce yeah. or in anything,
right.
and that works like a champ.
Cool.
But yeah, things are coming up pretty good. I was worried about, we still got a lot of time to grow, though. I mean, we still got 6 weeks of growing
well,
left.
Things come due
yeah.
in different, you know, different times.
Yeah, right. The cauliflower has finally, I didn't think it was ever going to do it, but it finally started forming nice cauliflower heads.
Good.
They're coming out. The peas are a little bit late this year. Mm-hmm. They're just now, our peas are just now getting good blooms on them.
So our calendar has to be, that's another important thing that you don't think about as a gardener, is the importance of a diary.
Yes.
A yearly, sort of understanding of what is going on 1 year to another, but also what's not happening in the right moment that you thought
That's
it
right.
should.
And, you know? And you know, folks, David practiced his profession in Florida,
yeah.
but that even applies in Florida.
Of course. We're
yeah.
dealing with the same technology no matter where you are.
Just different plants.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right, different
yeah.
plants, you know, so it that's exactly right, but it's
understanding your environment, your specific little microclimate, paying attention to some of the peculiar aspects of where you are instead of
right.
what you read in the books.
Right. And we are picking green beans like there's no tomorrow. I mean, I planted them all in the greenhouse. I took one bed and it's all green beans. And Marty's out there every day picking green beans. Me too. The tomatoes have got tomatoes on. And I got to tell you folks this one. My neighbor two door down, old Mike, my buddy Mike, he's a good gardener. He's a wonderful gardener. So he calls me up the other day and he says, Larry, you've got to come down. There's something wrong with my tomatoes. So I went down
too
there.
Too big.
I went down there and I got in his greenhouse. And we're looking at them, and I go, well, these look great, Mike. What's the problem? He says, oh, there is no problem. I just wanted to see how many tomatoes were on there. He has already harvested, he told me, 120 tomatoes that were green, and he's letting them ripen in the
yeah,
house.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I know that his plants, out of about 7 plants, they are loaded with tomatoes.
Was he doing some fertilization? Was he doing some...
Well, what improved his tomatoes, he yeah. got a bunch of manure compost from our buddy Fritz Miller at TNT Compost.
Okay.
And he put that in his raised beds, and boy, it has worked.
He ascribes that to
yeah.
his success?
Yeah, that's part of his mm-hmm. success, he thinks. I go, have you given him anything else? He goes, not a thing.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm in there, and I go, there's nothing wrong with
these.
They
may not be as expensive as they usually are.
Yeah, but I'm like, there's nothing wrong with these, Mike.
No,
he goes,
no.
I know, I just wanted you
yeah,
to see them.
I need to show off to somebody.
Yeah, he had to
yeah.
show off.
Yeah.
And he's a good guy. He gives me plants, and he said, do you need these? And I go, oh, Mike, yeah, I'll come down and get them, no thanks, I've got too many of those already.
I understand that when you're harvesting, the next thing that comes to mind is storing.
Right.
How the heck are we going to store all this stuff? And even though we may have a lot of August ahead of us, we can start thinking about storing it.
Right. And before, David and I were going to talk about that, but before we get going on that, one of the things I always tell you folks is go to the UAF Extension Service,
definitely.
uaf.edu, and go to their publications and go to the find a publication, and then there's topic areas. You know, they've got food, gardens, pests and invasive diseases, but this is the time of year when you're talking about preserving your harvest.
Mm-hmm.
We all work too hard to let things go bad. But when you go to the UAF page and you look at topic areas, you can click on food and you can click on gardens. And I'll tell you what, anything and everything you want to learn about gardening and preserving your harvest in Alaska is on this page.
Specific to Alaska.
Yeah.
It's that's University of Alaska, not University of Toledo.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's Alaska. You know,
right.
one of the things that... David loves in gardening and agriculture in general is the history of agriculture.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, for instance, some of the great gardens of Europe.
Yep, that's where that's my current specialty. I'm not doing any more designing, but I am working at learning a lot more about the history of gardens. But then when we had this subject come up with food storage, it did make me think about what I knew about ancient food storage. And that takes you back a while. The first evidence of granaries was in the 1100 BC.
Right.
1100 years, not 200, not 300, not 800, 1100.
BC. Right.
Yeah, before we got started. And what was interesting is the archaeologists now, with the technology we have, if we find a grain of anything in the bottom of a dig, you know, an archaeological dig, we can put it under the microscope and figure out exactly what the thing is. And they had granaries full of wild barley, not hybridized. There was what they could find and what was growing well at the time, enough for them to harvest wild barley. I imagine they could start concentrating it, but they haven't. I actually visited an archaeological site like what we're talking about with these granaries. It was interesting. It was in the middle of Turkey, but it was surrounded by sugar beet fields. And it just made me think as I got there, how long has this ground been agricultural?
And what year did they determine that area was from? What era?
Oh, 1100.
1100
BC.
BC, that area.
Yeah. But the point being, they're still growing stuff. It hasn't worn out. It wasn't an old... you could go to Detroit, and although Detroit is finding a new life in technology and in manufacturing, you know, you could go to a lot of Rust Belt cities, and they're not doing anything. Well, 11,000 BC, they were gathering enough barley for a granary.
Was 11,000 or 1,000?
11,000.
11,000
yeah,
BC.
Yeah, 11,000 BC.
Oh, wow, 13,000 years ago.
Exactly. Hunter-gatherers. You know, they hadn't gotten into agriculture, but they were gathering enough barley to put into a granary and store it, right? The idea is this same neighborhood is doing sugar beets now.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And you know what's neat about that, from what I've read about, you know, like in Mesopotamia, they found the...
That's what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
we're talking Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, back in basically the Middle East.
Yeah.
And... they have found seeds, like you said, from 10, 12, 15,000 years old, and some of them have sprouted.
Oh, yeah, they're viable.
They're viable seeds still. They're in that dry environment.
Yeah. They were put up.
Right. That's right. They were put up. They had their canners and their dryers, their electric dryers.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, and that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
That people knew that. You know, it's kind of like, David, it's kind of like down in, you know, one of the big things in semi-recent years is the use of activated charcoal in your gardens that you put in, maybe mix in with your compost tea and everything, and it gets in there and it slowly releases those. They have found layers of charcoal in the Amazon River Basin where the ancients used to garden. They knew about putting charcoal in their gardens back then that made better.
There's nothing like being hungry that will teach you things.
Yes.
You know? That's Pete, who figured out how to do all this, was able to live long enough to teach somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the ancient populations and indigenous peoples, you know, my wife and I've always had great respect for, like in Alaska here.
Yeah.
Who is the first person, you know, who is the first native Alaskan eons ago who looked at a razor clam and goes, I bet we could eat that. You know, and it's like this slimy thing. It's like,
Who's yum.
Yum. Who's the first person that said, man, I bet this big giant crab is good.
Yeah.
Who tried to eat that and it's like, well, and now they're $50 a pound.
Exactly. And it didn't kill Pete.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the well, we have examples right here in Soldotna of cash pits, which was the indigenous population who were doing their salmon fishing at this time of year, and they needed to put them up for the winter. They didn't want to starve. So they had two means of dealing with the fact that they had all this fish. Think about how many the entire community would have, like, fish all over the place. Well, if you cleaned them and put them in a pit which was waterproof, they knew enough to put in birch bark walls and fish slime to hold them together. And knowing that they were going to have a freeze coming up, believe it or not, you could actually layer in salmon into these pits. And in the wintertime, harvest your salmon out of those pits. There are archaeological digs right here at the college grounds, KPC
campus. On their property?
On their campus, yeah, right there. And they also did something called fish racks, which I think most of us are familiar with, where you could dry them and maintain viability that way. I was talking to you before the show about the fact that I'm from Michigan, and if you're in Michigan, you can go up to the northern edges of the Lower Peninsula to a little town called Leland, where there are fishing boats going out and getting whitefish, bringing them back, and hanging them, you know, cleaning them and hanging them out on the fish on their clothesline. And you could, this was years ago, they're probably, I don't know if they're doing it anymore, but you literally could buy, you know, dried whitefish and eat it on the way home.
Yeah.
So drying. You know, and I know that my son-in-law has got his smoker out working.
I've smoked some salmon this year.
This year already?
Yeah, I've smoked some salmon. And you know, when you know, like you said, that's people knew a long time, unless you just had that hunter-gatherer who are moving their camp all the time from different locations. They use the resources in that area, and they're like, all right, we got to move to a new place to gather more food. And then they started figuring out how to
grow it. Be agriculturalists.
Agriculturally, right? They started growing it.
But if you can't grow something, you might find yourself fishing, because you could figure out how to fish pretty easily. And another thing to think about is the Hanseatic League in the Baltic Sea. These were city states that just had a free trade relationship between each other. We're trading, you know, goods, and I imagine, some goods from the south for smoked cod or dried cod. It was they're now finding shipwrecks in the Baltic Sea full of cod carcasses, which their whole ship was full of cod coming to the south from as far north as the Shetland Islands. So, you know, fish processing. Being able to make something that you could trade with, you know, you can't really take a old fish, throw it in the back, and get it home and then give it to somebody.
Yeah. And you know what's really amazing, too, is, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, is when you were looking at, for instance, corn.
Yeah.
Corn is a grass, you know, and that grass, it's a plant, it's from a wild grass called teosinte. And it was originally it almost looked because corn is a grass, and it looked like a stalk of maybe Milo or not quite Milo or wheat or barley or something.
Yeah, something we would hack down.
But and that stalk that went up that looked almost like the tassels of corn, it had maybe 10 or 12 kernels on it. And they started, the indigenous populations started improving on that 9 to 10,000 years ago.
There we are. They were same era.
And it was domesticated in Mexico back then. And it spread through the Americas. And that's even them back then, before we got into chemicals and hybridization, they knew how to cross-pollinate them. And they're the ones that developed the corn. And you can still apparently buy, you can still get that, like, teosinte seed and grow it.
Yeah.
Like the ancient...
Unhybridized.
Corn. And that's why one of the other reasons there's so many varieties of it. And then, and a lot of people don't like it when I say this, David, but I'm one of those folks that modern science, whether you like chemicals or whether you like hybridization or whether you like genetically modified stuff, that has actually fed this world.
Yeah,
and I see. Like for me, I don't care if I'm eating a genetically modified piece of corn. Yeah. It doesn't bother me at all. It bothers some people, which is why a lot of people garden.
Right,
and that's okay if that's your thing. Me personally, that ability, for instance, to change the gene structure of a particular plant that might make it resistant to pests. Is to me it's magic.
It's something, isn't it, that we are talking about a history of people figuring out things like that that goes back as far as 10,000 BC, 10,000 years BC. But it's wisdom. It's taking something and saying, hey, the piece over here on this corner of my little plot is doing better than the north, that southern side, are. This particular plant looks like it's doing a lot better than all the others. Let's keep some of that seed corn for next year. And my whole group, my whole garden's going to be made out of that ear of corn instead of the other. It's not what you call anything but common sense. Now, that guy did not put a patent on that.
No.
I think the big difference is when you run into.
Yeah, but you know, David, it also is the same way for a personal gardener. Like, if you've got your greenhouse, if you've got whatever, and you've got a particular variety of plant that's just doing fantastic, and you want to let it go to seed, pick the best representation of that plant.
Yeah.
Let it go to seed, and that's the one you want to, like if you've got one broccoli plant that's making a head of broccoli that's 2 inches across, but you've got another one that seems to be a little different than the rest of them, and it's making a monstrous head.
Yeah.
Potentially let that one go to seed and collect the seeds off that one.
That's
to grow
your next
in the future.
Year. That's your
same
next
way
year.
With tomatoes. It's the same way with so many things.
Right.
If it was excess, especially if you like to save your own seed,
yeah.
Pick the best quality of the plant and the most successful, and you can potentially build one heck of a seed base
and a lot of
for
this,
future gardening.
Yep, a lot of this science that we're talking about came from peas, right?
Yeah.
The hybridization of peas and the fact that peas processed themselves, you know, quickly enough so that we could see the difference.
You remember the scientist who studied the peas?
No, who was that?
Mendel.
Uh-huh.
Remember Mendel, the study in the crossbreeding and the families of the...
Yep.
The
and, of course, you went from peas to peanuts.
Yeah.
And we've learned a lot of stuff by doing it.
Right.
There's probably no better way to garden than just to start.
Yeah. And, you know, when Marty and I were back in... we were back in the Midwest last March, and we went by Baker Seed Creek. Baker Seed Seed Company.
Nothing but seed production.
In southwest Missouri, in Marshfield, Missouri.
Uh-huh.
Mansfield, Missouri, I'm sorry. Uh-huh. Out in the middle of nowhere. And
it wasn't nowhere to them.
Yeah. But the guy that started this, he started many years ago, he was a high school student, and he started growing and started just selling seeds. Well, they've grown into one of the largest seed-selling companies. And when we were there, they must have had 25 to 30 massive high tunnels. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they only sell is heirloom. No crossbreeding. It's all heirloom.
Right.
And they're, you know, whenever you're growing heirloom seeds for sale, you've got to protect them, for instance, from in particular insects, because you don't want them cross-pollinating another variety.
That's right. They've been in that other tunnel.
With your variety. Yeah. And that's what they do. And I've seen some photos and videos of certain seed companies. If I remember, High Mowing Seeds might do this. They'll have a field full of particular plant, mm-hmm. and they will put a gigantic tarp over the top of
right.
it that lets light and sun through, but it keeps the insects out to prevent them from mm-hmm. being cross-pollinated. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's amazing to me. Can you imagine 10,000 years ago, where you're looking at these indigenous people, and if it was an accident, or if somebody was smart enough back then to go, let me try flicking the pollen off this plant
right.
onto this plant and
right.
see what happens.
Yeah. Accident, perhaps, but we've never been stupid.
Right.
You know, that's the and I always get a kick out of realizing that there's never anything but modern times.
Right.
At that moment, he was a modern gardener.
Somebody 10,000 years ago knew what calculus and algebra probably was.
Well,
and didn't know how to express it.
Perhaps. But what I'm saying is that nobody said, "Oh, I think I'll do this. I'll do this antiquing thing."
Right.
Yeah, I'll do this. You know, only us would think of doing heirloom anything. It's like, right. hey, if it doesn't do it better, I don't want it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's what, that's why, you know, I always tell our gardening friends, if you're growing a hybrid, mm-hmm. You're growing a hybrid, is you don't want to, you can save the seeds from that hybrid. Like a hybrid tomato.
Yeah.
And the seed packet will always say F1 on it.
Uh-huh.
F1 is a hybrid.
Uh-huh.
Well, you can save the seeds from that plant and grow it, but it might not exhibit the characteristics of that plant. It might exhibit the characteristics of either one of the parent plants.
Right.
You know, you might have a tomato that is bred because it's got a better root system and a better growing stalks mm-hmm. and everything. Mm-hmm. And this other variety has better fruit. Well, you might get a tomato that it grows it's great, but it doesn't have very good fruit.
Luck of the draw.
Yeah, so yeah. that's why it's tough to save. Yeah. And, you know, it's like some people are growing potentially seeds from the grocery store on a tomato or
mm-hmm,
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that might be fine, but you don't know if that's a hybridized tomato. They don't tell you this is a tomato of a cross between so-and-so. So you just see the
it's
$9 a pound.
And are wrapped up in cellophane.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you don't have any clue as to what variety that is. So they'll grow, but you're taking a chance on when you're talking about
some food storage issues. Can you imagine I'm a tomato in Missouri, and I'm going to get sold in Alaska?
Yeah.
What's it going to take, and when did they take that tomato? How green was it before it got into its little package?
Right.
And I bet you there's a lot to be learned I don't know anything about, but can you imagine the storage challenge of getting something that you could sell?
One of the things they did, and I'm sure we've all done it, you get to the grocery store, and you buy this nice red tomato, and you get it home, and you slice, and it's as hard as a rock. Well, what they do, and I know some of this because my mom's old boyfriend got into the trucking business, and he'd be taking reefers full of vegetables places.
Across the country,
and he says the back of his truck would be full of green tomatoes. Well, what they do is they pipe in ethylene oxide, gas in there, and that turns the tomato red, but it doesn't.
No matter what it wants to do.
But it doesn't ripen it.
Interesting.
That's why some of these red tomatoes they're really a green tomato that just artificially turned red.
Yeah.
And he said they would do that with strawberry. He said they did that with a lot of things. Hmm. And, you know, that's one of the things that they recommend people do. And I've never done this, actually, but I've read the recommendations of, if you've got something that you want to ripen, like a tomato, if you drop a banana peel in the bag with the tomato, it releases ethylene oxide as it starts
to rot.
To decompose.
Yeah, yeah.
And it helps to ripen those. You know,
I hear all of that, and it makes me tired thinking about it.
No kidding. But it's a, yeah, it's a, but it's amazing what, like, you sit there and wonder, and you go, who's the first guy that thought you could fake mature
yeah.
a tomato?
Yeah.
With, well, this gas.
Yeah, that, again, a happy accident. That's what historians should be doing, is figuring out who that guy was. Coming from Florida, my kids went to a grade school called Gorey Grade School, and it was because Mr. Gorey invented air conditioning. And he didn't do it so that we could live in Florida 12 months out of the year without sweating. He did it for the ice that was being used in the train cars, the box cars, trying to get their goods up to the north without their rotting. And so it was an industrial, sort of application of air conditioning that he used for these cars, i.e., the reefer truck that you just talked about going from California, the Central Valley, all the way to New York City, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know, but I wonder, we are still talking about food storage,
right,
in a weird way. But, New Jersey used to be called the Garden State,
right,
because they sold everything they could grow to New York City. How much is New Jersey still a truck farm?
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Now, if any of your listeners know, call us.
Yeah, or give us an email at growinggreenerkenai @kdll.org.
Exactly.
Shoot me an email, and I will.
I'd like to know. I know the Sand County down south. He doesn't make you think it'd be good for turpentine, but I can't think of anything I'd want to sell in New York from there. But, Long Island was a truck garden.
Oh, yeah.
And New Jersey was a truck garden.
Long Island was all farms.
Yeah, yeah.
All farms.
So,
and what a lot of people don't realize is, like, on the site where New York City is now, it used to be a little bit mountainous.
Yeah, well.
And it was.
Sure.
Flattened out.
But the idea of fresh food.
Right.
How fresh was that food cart going up and down the streets of New York? I'd say it was pretty darn fresh.
Pretty fresh. And, folks, what's odd, and Dave and I have talked about this before, is, the United States is the number one exporter of food in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But you would never guess, some of you folks might know this, the second most export of food in the world is the Netherlands.
Yeah,
isn't that amazing?
Doing
that
it little out of country, nothing, right.
That little country is the second.
Flat as a slither. Yeah.
And the third country for food exports out of their country is Brazil, And you're sitting there, and the next ones are like Germany and France, and you get into parts of Europe. But Dave and I were talking earlier about, you would think, like, with the size that Russia is and China, that they would be high on the list of food exports. But yet, they're not.
No, they're not.
They're not.
Poor old Russia. Food processing, right?
Right.
Like, if you had to eat, you'd start eating potatoes, because at least you could keep the darn things long enough to eat them. That Alaskans and Russians should really have a lot in common in terms of their growing season.
Ability to grow.
The growing season, right?
That's right. And it's just so phenomenal to me that the Netherlands is number two.
Yeah.
Now, folks, one of the things David does too when we're talking about gardens is, David has done some studies on some of the, like you see on Downton Abbey or something, the English garden, the big
country houses,
estate gardens, and they're typically have a center point and paths radiate out from them, and there's some of them that they looked, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, but they would look just like a blank field. And technology has allowed them to use whatever, be it an X-ray or something, and they literally are able to bring up what the old garden footprint was.
Ornamental garden designs have been popular the aesthetics, the design concept would change over the years. So you might be looking at a Victorian garden, but underneath it is a Georgian garden, and underneath that is a much more formal French style garden. And you can the archaeology now, you can find all that out, and but along with, back to storage, those big houses, and particularly in the northern climates, had walled gardens. And the walled gardens were food production. They weren't ornamental. They were laid out in rows just like we would today, except knowing that the deer in the deer park would have decimated your garden, the first thing you did was you put a wall up.
Right.
Now, in this case, brick walls, but the microclimate that you could create, these guys were not stupid. They knew that they had hot walls that they could plant against, you know, because of the nature of the sun and the orientation of the garden. And so that wall, the interior of that walled garden, had wonderful microclimates that varied, not two, but three or four that you could understand well enough to plant properly in. And so your shade-tolerant plants, they're shade-tolerant, the ones that needed more time, could go into the shade of that garden. And these were, the one I'm thinking of in particular, was probably 4 acres.
Pretty good size.
Big, yep. Yeah. Well, you had the whole doggone house to feed.
Yeah, you know. And you know, 30 years, probably at least 30 years ago, Marty and I were down here on the peninsula. We hadn't moved down here yet. Mm-hmm. And we went to one of the Garden Club roundtables, mm-hmm. and Bobby Jackson was there. And I asked her, they said, yeah, Bobby, and I said, well, what's the first thing I should plant in my garden? She goes, a fence.
Yes.
And you folks have heard me say that before, but a fence. Different people have different, you know, like back in the Midwest, deer are a problem.
Oh.
And one of the things people do is they might put a fence around their garden that's 5 feet tall. Well, a deer can jump that easy. But then what they do is about 6 feet away, they put another fence.
Mm-hmm.
Because that deer now, or 5 feet away, that deer now is not going to jump one.
Right.
They're looking at the entire jump, and they're like, we can't make that jump.
Can't do that one, yeah.
And that literally a double fence can help deter deer from getting in the garden and decimating it.
Yeah, we're in terms of food production, I think it's important that a lot of these methodologies came from the environment they happen to be in. If you're on the northern coast of Europe, you are a fisherman, but you've got to garden as well.
Sure.
And so you end up understanding the opportunities you have, and you better, you know, use them all.
And what's amazing is, you know, for humans, one of the most important nutrients that humans need is vitamin C.
Mm.
And it's amazing how here you got people living as far away from the ocean as you can get, but they knew there were certain plants that are high in vitamin C. You know, you all know the story about scurvy why they call the British limeys and all that stuff. They had citrus on the ocean to keep them from getting scurvy. Well, certain plants are high in, I think potatoes are high in vitamin C, you know, and these folks, like I said, 5,000 years ago knew that they needed to eat this for vitamin C. It kept them healthy.
Thank goodness the Irish figured that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Potatoes, you know, and you can look into, I wrote down a list of things, means of storing food.
Yeah.
And one is drying. And we've already talked about drying fish, but there's, you can dry a lot of things, right? There are dryers that you can put your fruit in, right?
Yep.
And you can end up with dried fruit. Then you've got smoking and salting. I don't think we do a lot of salting around here, but depending on where you are, as in Salzburg, Austria. Okay, the
came from the salt mine.
That's right. You knew that salt mine is a Roman salt mine. Okay, so people have known about salting for a long time, but smoking, we're doing it right in our house right now. Okay, root cellars. The Garden Club had a wonderful tour a couple of years ago of root cellars around here, so that technology is well understood. If you could get an ice house, if you had a northern climb where you could harvest the ice
off the lakes and
stuff,
there
are plenty of ice houses where you literally put in a well full of ice that creates the refrigeration.
And they used to, you know, when they were originally starting to transport fruit and vegetables across the country by train, they would, in the trains, they would put all this ice.
Right.
And then they would cover a lot of it with sawdust.
Yep.
And it kept it from melting as fast, but it still preserved the food in there.
That's all they had, but they knew they had. Now, okay, Joe, now you've got 2 days.
Right.
You got to. But the idea of cooling things is one method. And then pickling and fermentation. They have had beer found, again, in these same archaeological sites back, maybe not 10,000 years, but really way back there. They figured out how to do something with barley. Again, how to maximize the production, right?
And that would be pickling and fermentation would be one of the prime uses of salt.
Yep, that
to get
and
in
also
there.
Jars that all of a sudden you said, hey, look, that guy can build a really cool jar out of mud, right? As long as we can cook it long enough.
And you know, that's you're right, dear. That's one of the things. If you notice, if you remember, like in the Mediterranean, some of the Roman ships that are found.
Yep.
They have the amphora,
which is
that jar, but it's got a pointed end for stacking.
Uh-huh.
And they find those that some of them are still sealed with food goods in
amazing,
them.
Amazing, isn't it?
It's just amazing.
Yeah. The and then, but the one I hadn't thought about a lot is sugaring. And I said, what? Okay, fruit. I get that. You might, if you have a means of, you know, cane sugar or something like that, beets, sugar beets. If you had enough that you could actually use sugaring as a way of preserving, then that's not very common, but it's certainly anybody with a sweet tooth would figure that one out.
Well, the Egyptians used to sugar.
And, really?
And I'm not sure if this, I'm not sure what they, one of the things they used it for was sugar, water, and lemon juice. And I'm reading this, folks.
Yeah, I just looked this up real quick.
I thought you were
smart enough to pull this out of your head.
No, I couldn't pull this out of my head.
Okay.
But it was, they used it on their skin to remove their hair. And it was considered a sign of high status.
Fashion.
Yeah, it was fashion back then, you know. But you do sit there. And, you know, one of the things I think it was also used in food production is, you know, one of the best ways to make a steak is to marinate it with a coat of sugar on top of it. You know, it's delicious. I've done that before. Mm. But it's kind of one of those things of, you know, you look at sugar beets from many years ago, and you know they were using them as a food source too.
That's what I'm talking about. In the middle of Turkey, in a site that is 11,000 years old, you have somebody growing acres with tractors, diesel tractors, right?
Yeah.
High technology, sugar beets. And the agriculture is a place to find a whole lot about our history. If we just wanted to look into history generally, that's a good way to get into it.
And you might remember that I seem to remember, you know, the world in general used to pretty much be an agrarian society.
Of course.
A farming society.
That's why the kids are out of school right now.
That's right. That's why the kids don't go to school in the summertime.
We're working.
They're needed on the farm. But you sit there and you look at that, and now, you know, people, I think it was about the late teens or World War I or in the 20s, it started going from an agrarian society to a metropolitan
industrial
society.
Yeah.
Right. And more people left the farm. And then when the Depression hit, and a lot of people lost their farms.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the in recent year, well, I say recent years, the last 30, 40 years, that small farm is coming back into people. People want to leave the city and get their little 5 or 10 acres and and have a roadside stand and sell sell their wares.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that that's viable, but it's a reasonable hobby.
Yeah,
I mean, if you can do it, if you can do it,
it can be. Well, you look at somebody like Jackson Gardens. They're farming 9 acres, and Bobby's always said that it's a break even or a loss.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just she feels it's so important to try and feed people.
And teach people how to feed themselves.
And teach people how to do it. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Which is fairly noble, if you ask me.
Well, the one thing we had going for us at during the Liberty Gardens of World War II was that people hadn't forgotten a whole lot yet by then.
Right.
I mean, I know, you know, my mother probably not as much, but my grandmother certainly knew how to garden. My grandfather had always had a garden.
Right.
It wasn't a question of whether you did or not. It was, of course you did.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen pictures of the Liberty Gardens in World War II, where you might have a nice neighborhood with oak and elm trees down the street, and you sit there and you look, and every single front yard
had a garden. No lawn.
Not in the backyard.
Right.
In the front yard, a whole row of gardens.
Yeah.
Because people knew that, supplies are in short supply.
In urban situations, you now still have garden that are shared. You know, I don't know why it just dropped
community
out.
Garden
the community gardens. Community gardens, right. And you get in line to be issued your plot.
Yeah.
But then after that, you have a community of gardeners that you see all the time.
Sure.
And there's plenty of those still present.
And a bunch of those in Great Britain.
Oh, all over the place.
Yeah, they're all over now.
Yeah.
And David, tell folks about, we've got about 4.5 minutes left, but tell them real quick a little bit about that website you're kind of working on.
Just a little
blurb about that.
Okay, boy, it's way early.
Yeah.
But the concept is that every era had a particular style of garden, which is interesting to learn about. You know, the style of a Mesopotamian garden is well understood. But to go through a garden today, you might imagine that it was a modern event, uninspired by the people that actually gardened or created the design. What this website is going to be doing is putting the context, the historic context of this garden, of any particular garden. So if you're in Italy and you're looking at a garden from the Renaissance, you should know something about the Renaissance in order to understand the garden. And so the website's going to put those things together so that when you are touring, you can look at a particular garden on the website and understand what music was being played, what war was being fought, what average age people were able to achieve. You don't realize that up until the 20th century, 45 was old.
Right, right.
Okay, so there's a lot of interesting things like that that's going to come out. And thank you for mentioning it, but it's too early.
Yeah, it's a little early, but it's something you're working on.
Sure, thank you.
All right, well, folks, you know what that little bit of the Beatles and Octopus's Garden means is we've got about 2 minutes of the show left, and I want to thank you folks for listening in today. I had fun with David here talking about these different things. Don't forget to take care of your crops, of your harvest. You work too hard to let it go bad. You may be pooped for that day, but you've got to take care of it. And David, thanks again for being on the show with me today.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it was really a blast having David on. And don't forget about starting in September, the Garden Club monthly meetings start again. And I got to tell you, the president, Mitzi Long, let me know. It's probably going to be at the Alaska Christian College. They've not 100% yet, but they know it's not going to be at Kenai Peninsula College this year. So I will let folks know as soon as possible. Hopefully the next show they'll have it locked down, and we'll do that. Don't forget to hit our markets, our produce markets there at the corner of Coral Street and the Spur Road, Kenai Spur Road. Every Saturday starts at like 11 o'clock in the morning and buy local produce. So, well, folks, thanks again for listening to Growing a Greener Kenai. And thanks to David for being on the show. The time went really fast today. I think what we talked about is fascinating subjects. So, all right, folks, this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL, on 91.9 FM, Kenai and Soldotna. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in a couple weeks. It is 12 o'clock.